Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we have several bills. The advisory committee has several bills before your committee. Of course, you're quite familiar with them, having worked on most of them, as Senator Ivers did also. We have copies of the facts and findings and recommendations from our report, one for each member of the committee. Our report has, as of yet, is not published. We'll be out shortly. I think you'll find that the bills that will be before your committee that came from the advisory committee will be discussed in our presentation of findings and recommendations. Now, the goals and objectives of the advisory committee, of course, are multifold. And we have two bills before you today. I think most of you have been familiar with what we've been trying to do in this area, so I'll leave out any of the history or discussion of the advisory committee and would rather move straight to the bills proposed. First bill you have before you is Senate Bill 30, which involves the placement of spoilage or material that's dredged from the bottom of the a river by the Corps of Engineers on adjacent property. Mr. Edwards, would you care to make any comments about the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, my advisory committee, Madam Chairman of this committee. First, for the record, may I say that I have permission of the President of the Senate to testify, because in my present role, that would normally be prohibited. Senate Bill 30 was designed to seek to solve an inequity that occurs when the U.S. Corps of Engineers, or a public body, dredges in the interest of navigation and deposits the spoil on state-owned submersible land in front of a riparian owner, thereby cutting off his many of his riparian privileges to the waterfront. And the bill, in essence, provides that he may purchase this land at a price based on the value of the submersible land. It also provides for a public body to purchase this land, and it provides for a deferred payment. Now, there is a kind of a oddity in the concept that has applied to this. One port district, the Port of Portland, becomes the inheritor of land that's created by depositing of dredged spoil on submerged or submersible land. Outside of the Port of Portland, and there has been a conflicting Attorney General's opinion, but outside of that, the riparian owner, if he chooses not to elect to purchase, he loses the privileges that normally come with his ownership of waterfront land, except the common law privilege of access. This seeks to equitably solve that problem. The committee discussed a number of approaches. One was an outright grant. One was placing the value based on his back land. It's agreed that he's paid more money for his land to have the advantage of the waterfront. And it's generally agreed that in taking that land by depositing dredge spoil in front of it, he's lost the property value without due compensation. It's also agreed that the U.S. Corps of Engineers need not seek permission to place the dredge spoil in front of someone's land. They can do it at the place that's closest for the economy and convenience of the U.S. Corps of Engineers. That's about the essence of it.
Senator, do you
want
to
Well, I thought maybe it'd be advisable to have Mr. Hawes there.
I think it would be.
new provisions in Senate Bill 30 with the current law.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, you'll note Section 9 of the bill on page 5, Repeal 274-930. This was the old provision allowing the private owner of land to purchase the new strip of land created by dredging for an appraised value after certain notice had been given. What we have done is rewritten that provision, if you will, and provided that whenever the United States in the process or in the promotion of navigation creates these new lands upon submersible or submerged lands owned by the state and adjoining or opposite the upland or riparian owner, that the riparian owner, be public or private, can purchase them. Now, Section 2 on page 2 relates only to the non-public riparian owner. As Cecil indicated, in the Port of Portland, where the riparian land, or where the owner's riparian rights in the land had not been condemned out, he was given, without charge, the new land created in front of his riparian land. In other words, if the port hadn't purchased by condemnation the riparian rights or the owner's land immediately adjoining the river, then he would get for nothing the spoils that have been placed in front of it, creating new dry land. So what Section 2 does is allow the non-public riparian owner, in the situation we just described, to purchase from the division at a reasonable value, plus administrative costs incurred by the division, within 6 months, these new lands placed or created in front of his lands on state-owned, submerged, or submersible. Now, of course, if he owns the submersible land, in other words, that's the shoal water immediately before his upland, and they fill on it, and he becomes the owner of the new land as well. But this is a situation where he doesn't own the shoal water, where it's filled, and consequently, there's a new strip of land placed in front of his ownership. So then he can purchase within 6 months upon payment of the administrative costs and the reasonable value. Subsection 3 provides for the normal appraisal method between the division and an owner when an agreement cannot be reached on the reasonable value of the land. It provides, as current law does, that where each can appoint an appraiser and the third is chosen by the first two that were chosen, costs of the third to be borne equally by the division and the private owner. This new section applies only to lands created on and after the effective date of this act. We're not trying to go back into history and do anything new. We're trying to cover only the land that will be created from the date of this act onward. Section 3 merely amends existing law because, as I said, we've repealed 274-930. Section 2, its replacement provision, is put in there or substituted for the prior reference to the repealed section. Section 4 is the main change made with respect to public riparian owners in the situation described earlier. In other words, the public, a port district or whatever public body it may be, owns the riparian upland immediately adjoining the newly created land. What we've provided in the bill is that the public body owns it upon creation if it complies with this section. Now, this again is a carryover of prior law. But what we've done is to add some conditions. They still own it, but only if they comply. Provided now that they shall pay the reasonable value of the new land plus administrative costs to the division of state lands upon the similar notice as in the other section. The only difference here is that the administrative costs of the division shall be paid within 6 months after receipt of this notice, and that the reasonable value under this provision would not have to be paid until revenues are received from the land. Now, under prior law, the only payment a public body had to make was for the administrative costs of the division in transferring title to this land. And as with the draft here, they didn't have to make the payment of the administrative costs until they'd received revenue from the new land. So we haven't changed that aspect. All we've done is include the payment of the reasonable value. Again, if the public body and division cannot agree on the reasonable value, they can use the same appraisal method to determine the reasonable value. Okay, Section 5 takes on or brings in another aspect of this bill. All of these provisions are amendments or additions to what we call the New Lands or Fill Lands Act, currently in the statute, providing for the control of submerged and submersible lands and filling upon those lands. This is the filling as it respects the ownership of the submerged or submersible land, not the filling as it respects the environmental results from that filling. So Section 5 merely says that through amendment, it effectively says that a public body may not create new lands by fill or deposit upon state-owned land without the permission of the state. Under the old law, a public body could, just as the United States Corps of Engineers could, fill land, submerged submersible lands owned by the state within its particular district or territory or jurisdiction, and all it had to do was notify the division of the filling. Now, if it's going to do it, it has to do it with the permission of the state. 274-940 is amended in Section 6, again to exclude the prior preference given to any public body. As you see, the Division of State Lands could reserve new lands from sale, transfer, or lease to anyone other than a public body under prior law. The restriction to anyone other than a public body has now been removed. So they may reserve, sale, transfer, or lease to anyone, including a public body. Section 7 is the existing Port of Portland law that I mentioned earlier. What we've done is to delete subsection 1, which provided for this specific free grant of new lands created on state-owned, submerged, or submersible lands where the upland riparian owner had not had his riparian rights condemned out by the port or the public by the Port of Portland in exercising its authority. Section 8 is just a statement of intent in the bill to clarify the fact that we're not trying to affect any lease, transfer, purchase, or other action taken with respect to submerged or submersible or new land created prior to the effective date of this act.
Any questions under Iowa?
Steve, Section 2, of course, deals with the United, both Section 2 and 4 deal with the United States doing the filling.
Okay.
Suppose some other public body, like the Port of Portland, does the filling. Do they have a right, the riparian owner, to purchase that land the same rights as they do where the United States does it?
Well, first of all, under this bill as it's drafted now, or under the new land law that would be changed if the bill were enacted, the United States is the only one allowed to make the fill in promotion of navigation or commerce. As the bill's drafted, it relates only to the new land created by the Corps of Engineers in effect.
In Section 5, doesn't it say that others can do it if they receive permission?
That's right.
All right, so the Port of Portland receives permission. Does the riparian owner have a right to purchase that then?
No, in most cases, and I have to harken back to some Port of Portland law, in most cases where a project's being undertaken of this nature, the Port of Portland owns the riparian land behind it. And what they're doing is merely extending their land into the waterway for whatever purpose.
They would automatically, by filling this, even though it's land they don't own, become the owner of it?
Well, no. I'm not, saying that. I'm saying, assumedly, if they get permission from the state, then it will be under 274.915, a sale, lease, or other transfer of land owned by the state. This only respects the, or only takes care of the aspect of it where the new land or the strip of land is created as a result, really, of dredging.
Of course, the court has to dredge it too.
Are there any controls that are placed on the Corps of Engineers when they dredge to determine how they should lay out the dredge material whatsoever?
Madam Chairman, we had testimony that the engineers were all powerful, that it's a navigation servitude, that they need not ask permission of anyone to place it, and that if it's for the purpose of navigation in their judgment, they could operate it.
You then anticipate that the method here by which you determine value would be placed upon the manner in which the dredge material was laid up at the level, or the landowner had to assume that the landowner had to do a lot of work to place the material in a level condition. Or
Madam Chairman, if there's a weakness in the bill, the manner of determining value probably is it. This, however, was the suggestion from the Division of Lands as a way to do it. Some states do it by evaluating the backland of this man. They say, well, how much is your land worth back here? And that's taken into consideration to determine the value of the new land because they've taken away his waterfront. Madam Chairman, to get this a little bit in focus where the problem is, now it can be any place in the state where there's the navigable waterway and dredging, but the acute situation is on the Columbia. As a matter of fact, there's one strip where in front of the riparian owner's land, they've extended the land 600 feet out into the waterway. And it really shut it. So it's on state-owned land, which is held in trust for the benefit of the Common School Fund. So it was believed that some kind of a compensatory program should be adopted take care of that situation. If school lands are taken, and something should be done for the man who's lost his many of his riparian privileges, he still retains the privilege of access, whatever that means, I'm quite sure.
Of course, the other thing you've done, too, is you may have placed an individual in a position where he could not even consider buying the added new lands because of the volume.
Chairman, responding to that, I think that's a very proper criticism of the bill, but we couldn't think of a better way. We thought about just making outright grant. Some states virtually do that, but in this case, you'd be giving a man maybe thousands of dollars worth of land that really belongs to the Common School Fund. It's a very
well, and that way he wouldn't have to hire an attorney, so that would be
well, the rest of it, isn't that much because the value is on page 3 of 916, the reasonable value of the submerged land before it was filled.
If I could make one response to Senator Smith's comment, we did find that as a matter of practice, in most cases in the Corps of Engineers activities in this state, they get a consent from the adjoining landowner to go in and fill in front of his land. In other words, if they have a dredge operating off the shore, and it's easiest and most economical for them to dump it in front of Farmer A's land, then they'll ask Farmer A for a consent, and they'll generally get one. Now, they don't have to, but they always do. This was one problem in drafting the bill. Originally, it was to be to take care of the person who was being or having a strip of land imposed on him against his will. But if they're getting a consent, then it's not entirely against his will.
Well, this matter of consent, the engineers made it clear they didn't need to get it. And on much of this land on the Columbia that we went down on the field trip and reviewed, no consent was obtained. They just did it. But the riparian owner sort of thought he was ending up with the land at the time. It was a rude awakening.
Other questions?
As we began our discussion of various regulations on the navigation servitude, we very quickly learned in our discussions that the riparian owner has the right to wharf to the center of navigation for moving commercial or other definition of commerce as it changes or has changed through history, transporting goods. But we also learned that the current Wharf Act, which was drafted in 1862, does not or exempts the new lands or filled lands laws passed in the last several sessions of the legislature. It was possible then for someone to go to the center of navigation by placing a fill on submerged or submersible land without permission from the Division of State Land, or at least that possibility existed. So the committee felt that we should amend the wharf law and allow an individual to wharf out to using his riparian right to wharf to the center of navigation, provided he get a fill permit from the Division of State Land, as the current law on ordinary fills require. So this particular bill amends the 1862 Wharf Act, requiring that if a field or earthen field is used to build a wharf, then he must get a permit, the same as an ordinary fill that is not done under the wharf law.
Did you wish anyone else?
Yes. Cecil, have you got any comments?
Okay, well, agreeing with and amplifying the statements of Senator Meeker, in the beginning, shortly after statehood, I'm sure this was an extremely valuable tool to enhance the commerce and shipping opportunities of the producers of Oregon, which in that industrial phase was mostly agricultural products and wood products. There's only been one minor amendment to that bill in about 110 years. In those early days, there were no railroads and no road nets, and so the whole commerce of the state depended on water shipping, and that's why this grant on the public domain was made. Since the development of the road net, and trucking systems, and railroads, this has been of less significance to the economy of the state, and the law has been the subject of abuse by entrepreneurs. Name instances of so-called wharfs being built out simply to have restaurants or to have trailer parking, or as one recently in Portland that still, I believe, is involved in court, the docking place for a very palatial yacht. So since the original intent is no longer being observed and it's being abused, it was believed in the public interest necessary to exercise some kind of control, and yet leave the Tenchule Power to wharf out to the harbor line where it is a necessary thing to aid truly commerce and navigation. And that's what this bill is designed to do.
Just a couple basic comments. Senate Bill 31, as Senator Meeker said, does really differentiate between the New Lands Act that we were discussing in the last bill and the Wharf Act, as it is known. Currently under the New Lands Act, you'll see Section 1, Amend 274-905, the definition of new land. Currently under the new land definition, it distinguishes bridges, wharves, quays, and similar structures. It doesn't distinguish them on the basis of their manner of erection. Rather, it distinguishes them generally as to their use. So you could have a wharf, for instance, landfill, or wood piling or concrete piling. What we have done, as you see there, is to eliminate the old as distinguished language and to put in a specific statement that the new lands, subject to regulation by the state under its ownership ownership authority, does not include bridges, wharves, and similar structures constructed upon the state-owned land by other than artificial fill or deposit. So in other words, kind of in a backward way, we've said that all landfill wharves or quays now come under the new lands provision. Permission must be granted by the state before they're erected. Section 2, then, goes into the Wharf Act itself, and there were a couple reasons for amending the Wharf Act. One, to define, as you see in the new subsection 2, what a wharf means, and again, by exclusion, we say that it means, or it doesn't mean, new lands created upon state lands by artificial fill or deposits. So now we're only talking about artificial structures of wood, masonry, or anything other than the landfill. Now, Senator Meeker didn't mention one of the other things that we did in here. The 1862 language has very seldom been construed by the Oregon court, but in the Port of Portland versus Reeder case in about 1955, the court did define wharf for us, and I think it's the only case where the court did define wharf. And you'll see that we've rewritten change in the old language, which was use and accommodation of any ships, boats, or vessels that may or can navigate the stream or other like water, to the receipt and discharge of cargo. In other words, the use and accommodation, a rather general phrase in the old act, is now replaced by receipt and discharge of cargo, the word used in the court's only description or only definition of what the term wharf means under the old Wharf Act.
The receipt and discharge of cargo is the court, what the court said?
Yes.
And
the remains.
Wouldn't that limit possibly the, or is that the intention? Wouldn't that limit the possible construction? That is your intent.
It may limit. The court was looking at a case where, I believe it was marina pilings and walkways and houseboat moorings were going to be taken out by the Port of Portland in making a shipyard of some sort, or a turning basin for a shipyard. And they were concerned with whether or not these structures constituted a wharf under the Wharf Act. The court held they did not. They were not for the receipt and discharge of cargo.
What is cargo?
Cargo means hard commerce. The court didn't describe it very well.
What about, an important subject that we're going to be dealing with, or have been dealing with for a long time, more and more important? Cecil and I were talking about it. What is a navigable stream? If we were to adopt this definition, and if a court were to say that someone would undoubtedly argue, some landowner like me or mayor of Caudill, say that to be navigable, you must have something that is, you must have been receipt and discharge of cargo. My point is, this doesn't include a canoe, does it?
Well, I think
we have another bill that deals with the defining navigable stream, and that deals with the
How about for pleasure boats? That wouldn't.
Well, you see, we've gotten around the issue, if you will. Really haven't evaded it, but we haven't changed the issue by leaving the term commerce in there. Now, the court may, as it is doing now, increase those uses which are considered commerce, including recreational use. That seems to be the trend right now. And if they do, and that's commerce, then receipt and discharge of cargo, a vessel engaged in commerce, may come to mean recreational.
Is there a reason why we shouldn't define that now so as to include that? And that's not a rhetorical question. Is there a reason?
Well, I think the committee decided, as I recall, that we would let the court define commerce, as it has always done.
May I be responsive to the senator's question? I think we purposely tried to rule out marinas so that based on the Attorney General's opinion we could collect lease money from them for utilization of the state-owned submerged land. We know
we've given a short explanation of the Attorney General's opinion.
Well, it's 92 pages.
I'm worth it.
Okay. We sought to, the Attorney General's opinion simply held in essence that the state could require leases from users of state-owned submerged and submersible land except wharves. So we wanted to, is that 25 words or less? So we wanted to distinguish so that people with pleasure mortgages using the state-owned submerged land couldn't claim an immunity under the provisions of the old Wharf Act and would have to pay a lease to the common school fund.
Well, that's just to use an example that's not really close to home with me because the water's not deep enough there to put a wharf by my house. But let's say someone lived on a river where the water happened to be deep enough and wanted to put out a wharf to accommodate small craft, motorboats, etc. Would they, if this bill were adopted, be required to get a lease from the state land board in order to have a wharf?
If they're engaged in a commercial enterprise with a marina,
let's see here. If they're engaged in, well, let's say that they're not engaged in commerce. Let's say that I live down by deep water and wanted to put out a wharf for myself and my friends in a wooden structure. That's what we're talking about. Out into the river, into the Sandy River. Would I have to get a lease?
Madam Chairman, regardless of this bill, the Attorney General's opinion that I tried to summarize so quickly would require that he obtain a lease from the state land board if the water were navigable and if his land-based or supported structure was floating over submerged land, state-owned submerged or state-owned submersible land. He may own the submersible land, but if it was state-owned submerged land.
It would require one now or without regard to this.
Right. That's what the Attorney General's opinion holds.
And what would this bill do to that, if anything?
This bill, I don't see that this would affect it, except that I think it rules out that they could come in under the guise of claiming he had a wharf unless he was engaged in the handling and receiving of cargo and passengers and in commercial use and navigational servitude.
Senator Brown. If I may make a few comments at this point, I think there is a little bit of confusion between the effect and purpose of this bill and the included definition in Section 2 of a wharf. Under the current law, it is possible to use a landfill and at the same time to use your riparian rights under the 1862 Wharf Act without a permit. Whereas any other landfill in navigable waters or even submerged or non-navigable waters, you're required to get a permit. So if you could, under the guise of saying that this is a wharf, put a fill in when everyone else is required to get a permit, and you don't have to get a permit. And we felt that there had to be a change in this law, in the old 1862 law, to prohibit the construction of a, quote, wharf, unquote.
By way of landfill.
By way of a landfill.
But if we're just a wooden structure, maybe I didn't read this carefully at all.
See,
if we're just a wooden structure, it's excluded anyhow. Is that right?
You see, the riparian's right to wharf to the center of navigation for purposes of commerce is so so broad that it is impossible to prohibit it. But we can prohibit the use of a landfill without a permit in this area.
But then am I clear then, if one didn't make a landfill, can one construct a wharf without a permit?
Under this bill, Senator, if it's a wharf, quote unquote, for hard commerce, in other words, discharge, receipt and discharge of cargo, you could. If it's a pleasure wharf, let's say, and this is all discussed in that long Attorney General's opinion, if it's anything other than for hard commerce, or if it's allowed if it's not allowed under the Wharf Act, and we're trying to get the two to say the same thing here, that then you can go ahead and build your wharf. But if it's anything other than that, then the Attorney General says that the state can make you lease that privilege if you're building it out over submerged submersible lands owned by the state. If you own the submersible, the shoal water in front of your land, you can build out over it.
We probably should add, too, that the Corps of Engineers has a great deal to say about any obstruction in navigable channels.
Yeah.
I think we should note, too, that this bill is dependent on the other bill because of the issue of navigable zones. They should be considered together at a later time.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Ivan?
I'd like to just to be sure I have the right construction. The person, a riparian owner, could build a structure that would, as far as all intents and purposes, was a wharf, all the piers and all that, but it was not used in this broad definition of commerce. Would he be bound, like, say, he was going to build a fancy restaurant, and I'm concerned about this, out over the water somewhere? He would then come under the other provision where he'd have to get a permit from the landlord. Is that right?
Right. Well, no. He'd come under the general Attorney General's opinion. The general provisions of the opinion saying that he had to lease it from the state. The state can
that's
require.
What I'm saying. They could require a lease from him.
Sure.
He couldn't get by just because
that
it was a wooden structure
built
similar to a wharf and everything.
That was one of the reasons for deleting the old language, use and accommodation of any ships, boats, or vessels that may or can navigate. Use and accommodation was rather general.
So that there is ample authority to require a lease and rental under the Attorney General's opinion.
Oh, I think so.
Okay.
Mr. Edwards, is the Attorney General's opinion summarized in the committee's report?
It's sort of a headnote type of summary, Chairman. In a special section with all of the opinions that relate to this land-water relationship problem.
Right.
And if the committee would like copies of the whole opinion, which has something of a summary on the front of it, I'll be happy to get them. Okay. Could I make one comment about the leasing?
While we're still on the language, are there any historical documents that amplify the reason for the use of the original terminology? I know that's unlikely there are any minutes of that legislative committee, but is there anything else, or have you checked in any
I've
way?
Checked in a very brief manner, and I found nothing in my usual sources, let's put it that way.
Well, Senator Cook, this leasing program of the state is not new. It started in 1907, and there's a law on the books that relate to that. But in 1968, over an interpretation of the Smith, Tug, and Barge Act, Wayne Thompson wrote an opinion which held that the riparian owner took precedent over the state in the matter of requiring leases and that he could assign the state-owned riparian land lease rights. The new opinion reversed that completely, and put the state back in the leasing business. The state, in the past period up to 1968, collected as much as, I think, $84,000 a year, if my memory serves me, and they collected a total of something less than $600,000 since the inception of the program. And that involved leasing of marinas, leasing of log rafting sites, and other leases.
Madam Chairman, in pursuit of Senator Cook's historical documents, since there aren't any, do you remember when you wrote this 1862 bill, Cecil? I thought, you know, if you could pull it out.
Thank you for that sage suggestion of antiquities, Senator Burns.
No.
The reason that I'd be interested, and I think it might bear something, you know, something more than a summary examination, I wonder if this language perhaps came out of some historical cases that had special meaning.
I think you're right, Senator. Generally, in all the work I've done in this whole field, most of the law that's been written has been tied to direct court language. So
well,
I wouldn't be.
Would you like to have our counsel
working with Steve? Yes, just checking on that.
And you want both Worf and Thomas?
I'm thinking of the deleted language on lines page 2, line 23 and 4. So we can have a better understanding of exactly what we will be doing to the law if we replace the language. Now see if there's an old case that came out of back in 1850 or something, may have a meaning and be good for us to know.
Madam Chairman, Aaron Shalowitz in Shore Boundaries and Riparian Rights cites some cases that touch on this particular area.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Either 30 or 31? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Would you like a copy of the bill? Yes, I'd like a copy for each of the members.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stan Hamilton. I'm staff engineer for the Division of State Lands. I'm speaking for Bill Cox, the director of the division, who is in Eastern Oregon today. And speaking on Senate Bill 30, basically, the division has no objection to the bill. We would, however, like to make some changes in lines 19 through 28, which is the portion which,
page three,
I'm sorry, which would, which gives the public bodies the right to purchase at the submersible and submerged lands value plus the administrative cost, and requires the administrative cost to be paid within 6 months and the submersible and submerged lands cost to be paid when the public body sells, leases, trades, or uses the new land. We would like to suggest an amendment which would place a time limitation on the period of time that the port or other public body has to exercise their right to pay for it, purchase it. We would like to see preferably a 6 month period, similar to that used by the private body in that way we would be able to close out our books at a reasonable time. I have an amendment prepared that I will provide you if you'd like.
Yes, would you please?
Basically, the bill, as we see it, would have two or three different effects. One, it could possibly encourage private owners to seek inexpensive land by requesting the Corps of Engineers to place fill on state-owned tide lands, fronting their private uplands. This would amount to obtaining upland at approximately 16% of the appraised value of the final land. It also could, in our amendment is designed to eliminate the public agencies simply holding land that has been filled. Now, we don't have much of a problem with this, but it is something that we would like to forestall again.
Madam Chairman, I don't understand that. I don't understand the point, since we don't know what the value of the land's going to be. If it's a reasonable value attached to it, how do you know it's going to be cheap land?
Well, the, for instance, let's take a fill that's placed in Portland, somewhere in the city limits. The appraised value of that land might easily be in $30,000, $40,000 an acre. That's after fill. As it stands right now, the value of the submerged and submersible land prior to filling would run somewhere close to about 16% of what the final value would be.
How do you arrive at that figure?
Well, these are values that our appraisers have come up with based on what comparables they come up with. Granted, this is an area where there isn't a lot of comparable data because there isn't a tremendous amount of this going on. And there's a number of areas where the core in the past is filled, and these areas were more than willing to see taken care of. What data, what we have sold, we've sold approximately 10 of these parcels in the last couple of years. And based on that data, this is where we obtained the 16% value. And it's just a rough average. It varies from place to place.
Well, if I understand this properly, you're saying you may sell the land, and the person that's buying it must then go to the Corps of Engineers and be sure they place the fill on that land, and therefore he can buy the land at a cheaper price.
No, we wouldn't sell it until after it was filled. This doesn't, at the present time.
I can't follow how a person can develop cheap land. This is
well, simply by asking the Corps to fill it first.
But he must own it.
No, he does, not under the bill. Simply ask the Corps to fill it, even though the purpose of the bill is.
Of course, after it's filled, then it becomes more valuable, correct?
Right.
Then it's based upon its reasonable value, correct?
Under this bill, it would be based on the value of the submerged and submersible lands underlying the new land, which would be somewhat less than what it is after it's filled.
Madam Chairman, you say somewhat less. Didn't you just say it?
16%
or
something. Well,
yeah.
Right.
Thank you. Oh, you want to
push back 31 on 31, we support the bill.
Did you
give us
the amendment?
Here. On 31, we support the bill in its entirety.
You have any
comments? We support it.
Questions on Senate Bill 31. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Magruder, did you wish to comment on this bill?
Oh, I might make a comment on Senate Bill 30. I'm here for Mr. Meek or Senator Meek, represent Senator Meek right now. First comment, so maybe he covered this, but the intent of Senate Bill 30 was to provide the riparian owner with some protection of his, quote, riparian rights when the Corps did come in and fill against his land. So we were trying to, rather than actually in some ways extinguish his riparian rights, this was a means of solving that problem. In other words, giving him an opportunity to purchase that land at its pre-built value and protect his riparian rights if he so chose. Yeah, I might mention that this is something that affects my district, affects me personally to some degree too. The Corps, under the navigation servitude, fills along these lands. As it was, as Cecil mentioned a few minutes ago, they do generally seek permission, but in no way is that required. They're basically doing it on a cost factor, depositing the spoils where it's cheapest for the Corps to do it. So the riparian owner, although generally he signs a consent form now, I don't think the case has arisen where he didn't sign the consent form and the Corps wants to fill. I think they can, in fact, go ahead and fill. Now, whether they would or not, I don't know. Now, in reference to one of Senator Smith's comments concerning the riparian owner requesting fill, I think in the case of the riparian owner requesting fill from the Corps, he would run into some serious difficulty there, because the Corps, I believe, has a general policy that if you request fill, you pay for the fill. At least that's been the case along the
Is this the way
river.
We're getting cheap land along the country?
That's all.
Thank you,
Representative.
George Bell.
Madam Chairman, I'd just like to, I have nothing to offer to the testimony that's already been given on these bills. I'd simply like to indicate that the Secretary of State, in his capacity as a member of the Land Board, supports both these bills, including the amendment offered by the division.
And you expressed that you agree to the appraised value of the submerged and submergible land before it has a fill placed on it. Questions of Ms. Bell?
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Do you speak? Do you know the views of the other?
No, I do not. Chief Deputy State Treasurer is here. He might be prepared to speak for Mr. Redden. I don't think that representative of the governor's office is here.
Senator Iverson?
I'm not sure of his reply to you. Does the Secretary of State
yes.
support paying the value prior to the fill?
Yes. The amendment offered by the division.
Any other questions? And your testimony went to both bills?
Yes, ma'am.
Both 30 and 31. Thank you. Mr. Kennedy, did you wish to make any statement on behalf of the Treasurer?
Madam Chairman, no, I would not like to make a statement, but Mr. Redden would like to appear at a later date to discuss both bills with you. Very briefly.
Fine, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Barney?
Yes, Madam Chairman, there's an apparent impact on the City of
would
Portland.
Would you come up, please,
sorry.
Sit at the table?
I didn't wish to make a statement at this time. My name
well,
is Don
would
Barney.
You state your name and position?
Don Barney, legislative liaison to the City of Portland. There's an apparent impact on the City of Portland, and would like to ask for the opportunity, if there is one, for further comment or testimony to indicate what that impact might be at that time.
There will be such an opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Prime, Karen.
I'm Madam Chairman. I'm sorry, I signed the phone with the chairman. I thought it was Ms. Henry.
That's the end of the list of persons who have signed up as desiring to testify on Senate Bill 30 and 31 today.
So moved.
This amendment was offered in the Social Services Committee and passed unanimously. Mr. Harrington then noted that this would require the putting on the record of negative things that would adversely affect the child and become a part of the public record. So then it was repealed. I think by amending it to require only affirmative facts, there would be none of the negative things that come out in domestic relations to drinking or fighting or out at night or anything. It would simply give the reasons why they can't award it
custody. Well, if this is being done just for purposes of having something in writing before the committee for a later hearing, you're willing to vote for it, but on the other hand, if this is being suggested as a real policy decision by the committee, it isn't. We're going to have more hearings on this question later. Okay. There might be a question as to whether or not we should so complicate the proceedings by doing that, but if we're going to decide
no,
it later.
We'll see it in writing.
You have written the mandatory language prepared that would be amended into this in pursuant to your motion.
It would be prepared.
I have some of the same reservations, but I'll move it along, go ahead and vote and see it.
The entire bill would be considered a merit with the amendment.
With the amendment. All right.
My understanding.
Yes. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Zero. Motion
to adjourn. I move adjourn.
Right. Yeah, good.